Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
This morning I want to speak to you about a subject which I'm pretty sure you have never heard discussed in this forum, or probably never heard discussed in any other forum. What are you all doing here? We've come here to learn Torah? No, why have you come to learn Torah? Learning Torah is a mitzvah. Shulchan Aruch said we should learn Torah? No. I mean, why do you think that you should be doing what the Shulchan Aruch says? Why do you think the Torah obligates you? Why do you think the Torah is a book of divine origin given to Moshe on Har Sinai? Why do you have this belief? What are you all doing here? Well, I don't know about you. I'll tell you about myself. I'm a religious Jew. I'm not a Baal Shuvah. My family has always been religious all my life. I've kept Torah and Mitzvot. I've kept them. My brothers and sisters and parents and grandparents, we all keep Torah. It's a family tradition. We all keep Torah and Mitzvot. Is that all there is to say about it? It's a family tradition. We do it because we've always done it. That's all we have to say to justify this lifestyle that we... What if I was born in a Christian family? Would I be in church this morning praying to Jesus? What if I were born in a Muslim family? Would I have gone to the mosque on Friday and prayed to Allah? What if I were born to a family in Central Africa? Who knows what I'd be doing this morning? Is this all we have to say about ourselves? Is a whole religion based on belief in an event which occurred in the distant past for which there is no historical evidence whatsoever? Is this all we can say about our religion? About that which generates, which controls our entire life? This question has haunted me for many years. It haunts me today. It'll probably continue to haunt me for the rest of my life. But maybe there is something that we can say. And what we can say is, you see, I'm not just a religious Jew, I'm also a scientist. And scientists also have their beliefs. Their beliefs are called theories. And if we study how scientists come to their beliefs, maybe we can learn something about why we have come to our beliefs. Well, how does science work? Well, if you've ever gone to high school, you've probably heard something called the scientific method, a complete fiction unrelated to reality. According to the scientific method, science is based on facts, experimental facts, observational facts, facts which can be reproduced in the laboratory, so everyone can see the same facts. A scientist in New York and a scientist in Jerusalem and Tokyo and the North Pole and the South Pole, he can measure the same quantities. He can observe the same astronomical observations. That's the strength of science, that there's a consensus as to what the facts are. That's the bedrock of science. And after we have a number of facts on a topic, we try to find a framework to explain these facts. Some theory, some conceptual frameworks, a theoretical framework, and then we must perhaps perform more experiments to confirm it. Perhaps something comes out wrong. We have to modify our ideas, maybe to reject the theories and have a different theory. But the bedrock of science is facts. That's the scientific method, which is completely devoid of any connection with how science really works. I am now going to tell you how science really works. Science is based on theories, on concepts, on ideas. Scientists develop these concepts, and then after they have an idea, they look for experimental evidence, confirmation, to show that their ideas are correct. Maybe they have to be modified, maybe they have to be rejected. But the bedrock, the basic idea of science is theories, ideas, concepts. Let me give you an example. The standard accepted theory of cosmology is called the Big Bang Theory. And this theory is accepted by all cosmologists, all scientists. It is taught in every university, and those who proposed this theory were awarded the Nobel Prize in Physics. All my examples will be physics. I'm a physicist. The Big Bang Theory postulates an event which occurred in the distant past, which nobody observed, and nobody can observe. It's a one-time event which can never be reproduced. Sounds a little like Matan Torah, and yet every scientist accepts it and believes it. Why do they all believe it? It can't be reproduced, that nobody observes it. Why does everyone accept it? And the answer is that if there really was a Big Bang, the Big Bang theory makes predictions. And these predictions can be tested today. For example, the Big Bang theory predicts A. And I can go to the laboratory and I can measure, confirm A really exists. And the Big Bang theory predicts B. And I can go into the laboratory or take a telescope and I can confirm B. And the Big Bang theory predicts C, D, E, F, G. And every single prediction of the Big Bang theory has been confirmed. So therefore, the most plausible reason, why do I observe A, B, C, D, E, F, G? The most plausible reason is that there really was a Big Bang in the distant past. This is called the plausibility argument. And therefore, all scientists today accept and believe that there was an incident in the distant past called the Big Bang. Another example. There's a teeny tiny particle called a quark. Some of you may or may not have heard of quark. It's not some exotic particle. The quark is the basis for modern theoretical physics. The whole structure of modern physics is based on the theory of quarks. So from that, you probably imagine that scientists have observed quarks. When I say see quarks, I don't mean see with their eyes, with instruments. They've isolated quarks, they've studied them, they've measured their charge, they've measured their mass, they put them in fields and see how they go. And they know, they've studied all about quarks. And the truth is that, like, they've studied about electrons. You can isolate electrons, measure their mass and charge and so on. So the same thing has been done by quarks. And my friends, nobody has ever seen a quark. Nobody has ever seen a quark, and according to quark theory, it is impossible to isolate a quark to look at. Well, if nobody has ever seen a quark, why do all scientists believe in the existence of quarks? Why is this the standard of modern theoretical physics? Why was it awarded the Nobel Prize if nobody has ever seen a quark? And the answer is that if quarks really exist, then they predict that you should be able to observe Aleph. And we go into the laboratory and we observe Aleph. And quark theory predicts Bet. And we go into the laboratory and we observe Bet. And quark theory predicts Gimel, Dalet, Hey, Vav, Zayin, Chet. And every single prediction of quark theory has been confirmed. And therefore, all scientists believe in quark theory, even though they have never, ever seen a quark. Because it is most plausible. Why are you able to confirm Aleph, Bet, Gimel, Dalet, Hey, Vav, Zayin? The most plausible answer is because there really are quarks. And therefore, all scientists believe in quark theory. Now that we know how science works, let's apply these ideas to Torah. The basis of our religion is that there is an event, a one-time event, Torah min HaShemayim, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave the Torah to Moshe Rabbeinu, this book of divine origin, which tells us how to run our lives. Nobody that we know was there, was present at that event. Nobody alive today was present at that event. There is no historical evidence for that event. So how do we proceed? Well, we proceed the same way as science. The Torah makes predictions. The Torah makes statements. Statements which we are able to check and see whether they are correct or not correct. And when I say to check the Torah, I don't mean something prosaic like Israel is a land flowing with milk and honey, Switzerland and New Zealand also flow with milk and honey. I mean the statements which are counterintuitive, the statements which sound impossible, the statements which sound crazy and mythological and irrational, those are the statements that we will be checking. So let us begin. What is the most dramatic statement that we find in the Torah? The very first pasuk, Bereshit bara Elohim et haShemayim et haAretz. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth, the cosmos, the universe. The Torah tells us that the universe began through an act of creation. Well, for a long time, scientists thought creation is impossible. You can't make something from nothing. And now the scientists have had a reassessment. And the modern theory of cosmology, as I said a few moments ago, is called the Big Bang Theory. The theory is supported by a vast array of scientific evidence, plausibility arguments, and accepted by every physicist. It is taught in every university. It was awarded the Nobel Prize. And the central theme of the Big Bang Theory is that the universe began through an act of creation. And it is interesting and exciting to quote some of the world's leading authorities on the subject of creation. We begin with Professor Paul Dirac, a Nobel Prize winner from the University of Cambridge and one of the towering giants of 20th century physics. On a level with Einstein Mamash, Professor Dirac writes, quote, "It seems certain that there was a definite time of creation. Not it is possible, it is likely, it is probable, it is certain that there was a definite time of creation." We now go to Professor Alan Guth, America's leading cosmologist. Professor Guth writes, quote, "The instant of creation remains unexplained." We now turn to Professor Joseph Silk, another important cosmologist, University of California. Professor Silk has recently written a book on the Big Bang entitled "The Big Bang." He has no imagination in choosing a title for his book. The opening very first sentence of Professor Silk's book is, quote, "The Big Bang is the modern scientific version of creation." And finally, we come to Professor Stephen Hawking, the cosmologist with a capital C, the superstar of the University of Cambridge. Professor Hawking writes, quote, "The creation lies outside the scope of the known laws of physics. Today, every cosmologist speaks of the creation of the universe and uses the word creation, bria, to describe what happens. Because today, every scientist can take appropriate instrumentation, carry out appropriate measurements, and thereby obtain clear and unequivocal scientific proof that the universe was in fact created. The creation of the universe is no longer an article of faith. The rabbis can retire. The creation of the universe is no longer some sort of theological hypothesis. The creation of the universe has become a scientifically established fact, exactly as the Torah tells us." And what do all these scientists mean when they speak of creation? Creation of what? What object was created to begin the universe? And the answer is, the scientists have discovered that the universe began with the sudden appearance of an enormous ball of light. Scientists call this the primeval light bulb, but it has a popular name, the Big Bang, and hence the name of the theory. And this answers another question. What do we read in the Torah? On the first day of creation, we read, "Vayomer Elohim Yehi Or Vayehi Or." And God said, "Let there be light." And there was light. On the first day of creation, when there's no sun, and no stars, and no moon, and no light bulbs, and no matches, and no people, and no source of light anybody ever heard of. And the Torah tells us, "Let there be light." And for 3,000 years, nobody knew what these words meant. Maybe it's spiritual light, it can't be physical light, because there was no physical light in the first day. And now the scientists tell us, yes, there was light in the first day. Exactly what the Torah tells. It takes the scientists, the atheistic, goyish scientists, to teach us that the Torah means exactly what it says. And God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. That's exactly what happened. That is, the Torah does not report two different creations in the first day, the creation of the universe and the creation of the light. But the creation of the light was the creation of the universe, exactly as the Torah tells us. Second day of creation. Second day of creation discusses the Shamayim, the Rakia, the heavens, what a scientist would call outer space. And what do we read in the Torah? We read the functions of the heavens. And God separated between the waters below the heavens from the waters above the heavens. Waters below the heavens, I understand. Oceans, rivers, lakes, the Hudson, the East, East River, the Connecticut, water from the tap, regular water, but Ribono Shel Olam, what possible meaning could there be to the expression of water above the heavens? Has anyone ever heard of large bodies of water floating about in outer space? It sounds completely irrational. Therefore, my friends, I am happy to be able to announce that the scientists have discovered the water above the heavens. At the edge of the solar system, the scientists since the space program have discovered there are enormous quantities of water. The ice up there, ice, it's very cold up there. There's much more water at the edge of the solar system than there is down here on the planet Earth. If it were possible to bring all those ice blocks down to Earth and melt them, they would fill the ocean basins 1,000 times. The most common molecule in our solar system is H2O. The waters above the heavens have become an established scientific fact. And there it goes, third day, fourth day, fifth day. I've written a whole book on this subject, showing that for the whole 6 days of creation, every single biblical verse, every phrase, every word has its counterpart in the world of science. Today the scientists are telling us exactly what it says in the Torah, Kepshuto. In fact, sometimes the scientists even use the same terminology as the Torah, without knowing it, of course. They don't care two pins about what it says in the Torah. The agreement between Torah and science and the creation story is almost too good to be true. To summarize the situation by saying, at least regarding the first chapter of Sefer Bereshit, the era of contradictions between Torah and science is over. What else does the Torah tell us that sounds a little bit flaky? Well, in Sefer Devarim we read that the Jews, B'nai Yisrael, is an Am Chacham V'Nabon. We are a wise and clever people. We're not like the Frenchmen and the Chinese. We're smarter than they are. We're smarter than any other people. There's a politically incorrect statement if I ever heard it. But is it true? Are we indeed smarter and cleverer than any other people? If you ask a scientist, what's a clever person? He'll tell you it's somebody who won the Nobel Prize. Alfred Nobel amassed a fortune in his lifetime. He used it to establish a fund. And the interest on this fund goes to give five prizes, Nobel Prizes. Three are in science. I'm only speaking about the science prizes. There's a prize in literature and peace. That's out politics. Yasser Arafat, Nobel Peace Prize. I'm discussing the prizes in science. The prize in physics, a prize in chemistry, and a prize in physiology medicine. And these prizes have become the ultimate recognition of brilliance and contribution in science. There is no greater dream of a scientist than to be awarded the Nobel Prize. Up to three scientists can be awarded each prize. They've been giving out prizes for 100 years. We have lots of data. There have been over 600 Nobel Prize winners in science. And what percentage of them do you think are Jews? Hold on to your hats, my friends. 23% of the Nobel Prize winners have been Jews. Okay, you can argue a little, who is a Jew? 20% glatt kosher Jews. And what proportion of the population? I don't mean the whole world, not Central Africa, where they do research. The Western Hemisphere, Europe, the Pacific Rim, we are at most, really less than 1% of the population. We have won not 1% of the prizes, not 2%, 5%, 23% of the Nobel Prize prizes have gone to Jews. Am Chacham V'Nabon. Just a few weeks ago, the prizes are always distributed on December 10th. That's the day that Nobel died. He wrote this in his will. The prizes on his yard site are to be given. This year, there were seven awards given for physics, chemistry, physiology, medicine, even one Israeli. Of these seven winners, how many were Jews? Four! If you're schwach on arithmetic, that's 57% of this year's Nobel Prize winners were Jews. We are 1% of the population. Am Chacham V'Nabon. And not just in pure science. Take technology, the Wall Street Journal, not known for pro-Zionistic tendencies. They give awards in technology. Every several years, they give three awards. The last time, two of the three winners were Israeli startup companies. Yes, we let one Goyish company win. Should look like we're discriminating against the Goyim. And not just in science. Take a field totally removed from science. Music. Who are the great violinists? There's Isaac Stern and Yehuda Menuhin and Yitzhak Perlman and Yasha Heifetz and Nathan Wilson and Pinchas Zuckerman, pianists, Vladimir Horvitz, Arthur Rubinstein, Daniel Gruenbaum. We are 1% of the population. And in every field of human endeavor, which requires creativity and originality and brilliance, and then the Jew stands at the forefront. The iconic figures. Who is the iconic figure in science? It's Albert Einstein. Who is the iconic figure in psychology? It's Freud. Who is the iconic figure in economics? It's Karl Marx. If you don't like Marx, there's Paul Samuelson and Milton Friedman. Every single area which requires brilliance, creativity, the Jew stands at the forefront. The Goyim who hate us have called us everything. We're murderers and we're rapists and we're thieves and we're blot on this humanity. And we kill Christian children to use their blood to bake our matzahs. But no anti-Semite ever said that we were stupid. Am Chacham V'Navon, and our brilliance of the Jews is recognized worldwide. What else does the Torah tell us that sounds crazy? Well, Torah tells us that because of our iniquities, we will be driven from our homeland. And it happened. It's not so strange. Many people were driven from their homeland. But the Torah tells us that in the fullness of time, the Kodesh Baruch Hu will have mercy on us and will bring us back. That God will bring us back to our homeland. And my friends, it has happened. In our lifetime, a unique event in history, there's no other example of this planet where a nation has been dispersed throughout the world, and 2,000 years later, they somehow came back and developed themselves. But we have done so. We have established a thriving Jewish democracy in our ancient homeland. We have made the desert bloom. We have developed an economy which is the envy of the world. We have an army which is the most powerful army in Little Israel and the entire Middle East. We have become the startup nation of the world, just like the Torah tells us. And the others think it never happened. The Romans in Rome have nothing to do with the ancient Romans or the Roman Empire. They have a different language and a different religion and a different culture, and they're not the descendants. They're simply occupying the same real estate. Like the Greeks and Athens and the Egyptians and Persians have no connection between the modern Persians, the modern Egyptians, and the ancient Persian Empire. But we in Israel have the same religion as our ancient forefathers. We have the same language, we have the same culture, and we are the descendants of the ancient B'nai Yisrael. Just like the Torah tells us will happen. A unique event in human history. What else does the Torah tell us? That sounds a little crazy. Well, after the creation, and after Noah, again, after the Teva, the Shpochu turns to Adam and turns to Noah, and he says, it's all for you. Everything in this world is really for you. Enjoy it. That's what the world was created for you. That is, the universe is not some random arbitrary place. There was a purpose in the creation of the universe by a Kodesh Baruch Hu. There was a purpose. and the purpose as human beings. You and you and me. We are the purpose of creation. The universe was designed specifically to permit the existence and welfare of human beings. Well, that's quite a claim. Is there anything to support this claim? If you ask a scientist, an atheistic goyish scientist, when he looks in the universe, does he see any signs as if the universe looks like it was specifically designed for human beings? And the remarkable answer to this question is yes. Yes, in the last 30, 40 years, scientists have uncovered an enormous number of features of our universe which make it look as if the universe was specifically designed for human beings. They've given this a name. It's called the anthropic principle. Anthropos means man in Greek, like anthropology, that the universe looks as if it's been designed. You have a whole chapter in this book. I can't tell you the examples. There's no time. What the scientists have discovered to make the universe look like it. But I'll quote you what the scientists say. And all the scientists that I quote, I want to mention, are complete atheists. I got to say that because they sound like your local rabbi. We'll start with Professor Freeman Dyson. Freeman Dyson is the world's foremost mathematical physicist of the 20th century, a professor at the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton. If you haven't heard of that research institute, that's where Albert Einstein was a professor many years. Not a place for schmendrickin. Professor Dyson writes the following, quote, "As we look out into the universe and identify the many features of physics and astronomy that have worked together for our benefit, it almost seems as if the universe must have known that we were coming." As if the universe must have known that we were coming. So speaks a completely atheistic scientist, world famous in his field. Well, that's the physical sciences. What about the biological sciences? Well, in the biological sciences, the most dramatic event which ever occurred is the transformation from inanimate material to living cells. The origin of life. What do scientists know about that? Well, the origin of life is a branch of science called molecular biology. It's only been around 50, 60 years. There's been great progress. They discovered the molecules of life, DNA, these long thread-like molecules. Sections of DNA are the genes. Genes determine what you are. Elephants have elephant genes. People have people genes. Worms have worm genes, and so on. The structure of DNA, there's been lots of progress. And what have scientists learned about the possibility of transforming inanimate material into living cells? On this question, I would like to quote Professor Francis Crick. Francis Crick is a world authority on the origin of life, the double helix of DNA, the famous, that's Francis Crick. That's what he won his Nobel Prize for. And Professor Crick is a militant atheist. Why do I say that? You'll hear the quote and you'll know why. Professor Crick writes, quote, "The origin of life appears to be almost a miracle." Almost a miracle. So many other conditions which would have to be satisfied to get life going. He doesn't mean a miracle in the religious sense. The man is an atheist. He means a miracle as if Israel should win 10 gold medals in the next Olympics. If this world famous scientist, a man completely devoid of any shred of religious feeling, finds it appropriate to use the term almost a miracle to describe the conditions necessary for life. You can imagine that these conditions had to be special and super special and super duper special and super duper glooper special, and somehow they were all satisfied. And life began. Aren't we lucky? The anthropic principle. All these conditions somehow were satisfied. And life began. Well, that's life in general. But as I said, the purpose of creation was not to get to the crocodile or the kangaroo or the cockroach. The purpose of creation is us, human beings. What have the scientists discovered about something special about the conditions necessary for human beings? And the answer is yes, they sure have discovered it. And on this subject, I want to quote Professor Stephen Jay Gould. Professor Gould is a Jew. Don't worry, he's a Jew, but don't worry, he's a complete atheist. Professor Gould writes the following. Let the tape of life, he imagines the development of the animal kingdom as some sort of a videotape. Let the tape of life play again from the identical starting point. The chance is vanishingly small that anything like human intelligence would grace the replay. Why is the chance vanishingly small? Professor Gould explains, quote, we are an improbable and fragile entity, the result of a staggeringly improbable series of events, utterly unpredictable and quite unrepeatable. Not an improbable series, a staggeringly improbable series of events. To get the human beings, A had to happen, and then B had to happen, and C and D and E and F, he has a 320-page book describing what these events are. And all these events somehow just happen to occur in the way you need them, in the order that you need them, and here we are today. And what does Professor Gould have to explain how it came about? The staggering improbable series, Professor Gould says, it's all luck. Well, maybe it is luck. But maybe it isn't just blind luck. Maybe there's a guiding hand behind this staggeringly improbable series of events. If you are looking for the fingerprints of HaKadosh Baruch Hu in the development of this universe, there's no better place to look than the staggeringly improbable series of events, which were necessary for human beings, and they just happened to. Professor Gould writes later on, it fills us with amazement because of its improbability that human beings exist at all. Like the distinguished professor from Harvard, I too am filled with amazement that human beings exist at all. Professor Gould speaks about luck. I think there's a different explanation for these staggeringly improbable series of events. And there are many, many more features of the universe which somehow are necessary and occurred for human beings. I have a whole nother chapter describing them. I can't tell you everything in a single lecture. It is absolutely fantastic. And it's time to summarize. As a scientist, I passionately believe in the Big Bang Theory. And I passionately believe in quark theory, even though nobody has ever witnessed the Big Bang and nobody can reproduce the Big Bang. I believe in quark theory, although nobody has ever seen a quark, and it is in principle impossible to ever see a quark. And the reason I believe in these two theories is because all the predictions of the Big Bang theory and all the predictions of quark theory have been confirmed. So the most logical explanation of why all these predictions have been confirmed is that there really was an event called the Big Bang. There really do exist quarks, even though we cannot directly observe either of these. And as a Jew, I passionately believe in Torah Mi-Sinai. I passionately believe that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave the Torah to Moshe Rabbeinu, this book of divine origin that tells us how to lead our lives. And my belief in Matan Torah is bolstered and supported by the fact that all the predictions written in the Torah have now been confirmed to be absolutely correct. And therefore, there's logic and reason in disbelief. So all of you gentlemen who have come here today, there is logic and there is reason and there is good reason in the fact that you have come here today. Therefore, You have a right to be here. You did the right thing. Thank you very much. Questions? Yes. You're not allowed to ask questions. Yes. Questions? Can you speak a little louder? You don't have to.
You talked about the Big Bang Theory as being very close to what it says.
Yes.
I ask this question very humbly, but because I really
don't need propaganda, I just ask.
Big Bang Theory is mine.
Yes. Next question. Yes.
I saw a program using me with Stephen Hawkins, and it describes how the Big Bang Theory couldn't happen. Not the HBO, you know, certain theory.
Of course.
Very naturally, and he made fun of the idea of God being.
Of course. All the scientists who are, every scientist I quote in my book or in my lectures that come, never quote religious scientists. As a matter of principle, if he's a religious scientist, maybe distorts or twists things to satisfy his religious beliefs. Every scientist that I quote is glad trace. That's the science. What do the scientists say? Spontaneously. The part into the spontaneously. That's possible. That's what the scientists, what the atheist scientists believe. I can't say that they're wrong. I'm not here to prove that the Torah is correct. I'm here to say that the scientific findings are consistent with the Torah. You can become creation when the scientists say it just means it had a beginning. It somehow popped into existence. This is possible. It's called a quantum fluctuation. It's possible. But it's also it's consistent with what the Torah says. That's all I want. Stephen Hawking's a very clever man. He's much cleverer than I am. But it's consistent with the Torah. That's my point. Yes, sir.
Could they explain why Big Bang began at that particular time?
No one knows why Big Bang began. No one knows. It's not a question. No one knows. Yep. Other questions? Yes.
How's the passage of time explained?
How is the passage of time, the scientific time, at the end of the time? This is, I have a principle. Good questions don't have short answers. Not be respectable to the question or the questions to say, hop-lop, an answer. But in my book, chapter 2, the age of the universe, if you know what the Rambam writes, more than Ruchim, write down Perek 2, chapter 25, the Gemara, Basanhadrin, other sources, you'll see there's no contradiction between the true Torah tradition and what the scientists say, but I can't explain everything in a single lecture. Chapter 2 in my book, it's all there, no problems, not to worry.